Introduction in Ecclesiastes 1:1-1:11. The first talk in a series on Ecclesiastes was presented by Wes Hurd on January 26, 2003 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a non-profit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Some of you may not know Wes, and so let me introduce him to any of you who don't. I'm sure most of you do, but if any of you don't, Wes is the guy who started all of this years ago. He started McKinsey Study Center, which grew over time and added to the staff and created a community that I appreciate. It's been the best thing that ever happened in my life to be able to come here to Eugene and to live in this community and think and study in this community. The kind of freedom, the kind of support that this community has given me is just invaluable. And the credit needs to go to Wes, who started this. It gradually cloned itself into Art Project and Gutenberg College and is what it is today. So thank you, Wes.
So if you do have a Bible with you, we're going to be looking at the book of Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes, what a strange book. There was a time early in my Christian life when I was first starting to study the Bible, starting to get my adult brain, as Jack refers to it, and starting to study the Bible, that I read through the book of Ecclesiastes. Or had someone refer me to it or something like that. And as a result, I thought, oh my gosh, what is this book doing in the Bible? This guy was not filled with the Spirit. He has a very dark, sort of melancholy, sort of pessimistic outlook on life. And it comes out very quickly in his writings. I'm absolutely certain that I still don't have, I'm only beginning to get the drift of this book, and I certainly am maybe not the furthest thing from a Bible scholar, but I'm out there. So it's always a bit of a struggle for me, especially to go back into the Old Testament where I don't know Hebrew. I have to do my word studies kind of through English and into transliterations and then back, so it takes me a while to do it. But I'm becoming really amazed by this writing. And I hope that over the next couple of weeks, I can transfer a little bit of my own enthusiasm and the kind of impact that it's made on my thinking. In other words, I have a growing grasp, I think, of the relevance of this book to us today, just to any human being who is looking at the world and at themselves, at reality, and trying to figure out what this is all about. Because essentially that's what Solomon, the author of this book, set out to do. There's an interesting... So what appears to be at the very beginning a kind of Solomon, the author, appears to be this kind of bitter, depressed old man looking back at his life and writing these poetic remembrances and proverbs and observations about his life and about his observations. I think there's really a genius behind this, and I think the tone of the book and how he goes about it is this really interesting blend of the true person, the deep, real person of King Solomon. We assume he's the author. We don't have absolute proof, but there's good strong evidence that he's the author. There's this interesting blend of both his personality that comes through in a really in a way that maybe only is rivaled by the Psalms, where David, you really get to know David, in a sense. You get to know something about him. You feel you feel his person, his personality, his outlook, who he was. You feel his passion. And there's a very real sense in which the same kind of thing is going on here, only in a really different direction and coming from a really different place. So from that perspective, it's an interesting study. And he gives some clues to the purpose of his writing right in the last chapter. And if you have an Old Testament and you have your Bible to open to Ecclesiastes, you can turn to the last chapter, which is 12. Which, by the way, I'm not even pretending that I'm going to get through this book. I'm hoping to get an introduction to the book done today and get us as far into chapter 1 as I can. And if it does work out, we'll try to get all the way through. But in this last chapter, the writer summarizes his observations, brings some things to a fitting conclusion. But just before he finishes it, literally with the last couple of sentences, he says in verse 9, he says, "In addition to being a wise man, the preacher," that's the author, that's Solomon, that's what he calls himself in the book, the preacher, "also taught the people knowledge, and he pondered, searched out, and arranged many proverbs. The preacher sought to find delightful words to write words of truth correctly. The words of wise men are like goads, and masters of these collections are like the well-driven nails. They are given by one," what I think, the one shepherd, God. It's interesting because the language he's using is, on the one hand, apparently Solomon, the preacher, is very aware, he's very consciously aware of the artful proverbial way, the art form that he's chosen his language, which was in some respects the art form of the Hebrews, but it was very consciously an art form. He chooses, in other words, delightful words that are artful, that are pleasant, that are interesting to read, that strike home not just because of what they say, but the way they say it. He says to write words of truth correctly. The words of wise men, these words that I've tried to write, in other words, are like goads. Does anybody know what a goad is? Do you remember in Acts when Paul meets Christ on the road to Damascus and he goes through that initial confrontation and sort of the beginning of this radical conversion? What does Christ say to him? "Saul, Saul, why do you kick at the goads?" You ever figured out what that's about? What's a goad? Well, a goad, it turns out, the word is translated a hoe in some places, an instrument, but it's more likely to be something like a long stick that a shepherd or someone who's leading and guiding an animal, a herd of cows or whatever, they would use these long sticks, and the sticks had a sharp point, sometimes a metal point on the end, and on the other end there was a blade. But the goad, that's what the goad was. And the language here is about using, in both cases in the New Testament here, the goad is an instrument that we learn from. That is, the cow or the animal that's being prodded or poked in a particular direction is, we assume, learning not to go that way, but to go that way. So he's basically saying these words that I've written down here are like, they're wise words that are like goads. I want them to be like goads to prod you to poke at you, to get you to think and to learn. So I think that's actually a pretty good summary, a simple summary of why he wrote this this book. Okay, I'd like to leave some time for a few questions at the end. So if we don't get all the way through, it's because I stopped to do that. It would be good to give a little background to Solomon, a little bit of context here. So that's what I want to do. First of all, the opening words of the book are the words of the preacher, the son of David, the king of Jerusalem. Who is this? Well, the word preacher, it comes from the root, apparently from the root Hebrew word for assembly. Excuse me. And the whole idea is the word Koheleth is the apparently the Hebrew word. And it's basically the idea that he is the assembly speaker. He is the one who stands in front of the assembly and teaches or preaches. So that's where we get the English translation preacher. So he's basically a teacher, and he's passing on his insight, his teaching, to guide, counsel, encourage, and prod the flock in the right direction. So the word Solomon, the name Solomon, comes, actually it's a derivative of the Hebrew word shalom, which means peace. Peace or peaceable, the idea of Jack Stenson talking about that, what that word means. Solomon was the 10th son of King David and the 2nd son of Bathsheba with David. And whereas David, his father, King David, had grown up in really among the common people as a shepherd. He was just an ordinary Joe out there, shepherd raised in an ordinary family. Solomon was raised in really in the heights of royal glory of the kingdom of David. And he saw both, this was in Jerusalem, Solomon saw both the beauty, the glory, the awesomeness, the power of the kingdom of being in royalty, and obviously what you would see with all that. But he also saw the chaos, the intrigue, the jealousy, literally the murderous hatred that often accompanies those who are at the heights of power and who are constantly having to adjust themselves and calculate in a political way, how do we survive? How do I keep my power? He was well educated. He never knew poverty. He never knew hunger. But he did know all those consequences that I just mentioned. Before he grew to maturity, several of his older half-brothers by other wives of the king met with violent deaths. They were murdered or lost. And one of his half-sisters was raped. So Solomon had a breath, to put at least a breath of experience in life, and both the glory, the beauty, the power, and the tragedy, and the horror, and the grief. Solomon reigned as king over Israel at a time that the kingdom was at its height, its peak of wealth, and in a sense its power as well. David, of course, had brought the kingdom after Saul, had brought the kingdom up, had raised it up, and it was it was a remarkable regime. And Solomon took over from that and was able to raise it even higher, in fact, to its highest peak in history so far, anyway. But the circumstances in which Solomon became king were kind of interesting, because the surrounding territories, the surrounding kingdoms, right there in Palestine, Egypt to the south, Assyria and Babylon were still sort of in their baby years as kingdoms. Of course, they would rise and become great great kingdoms of the Middle East. But at this particular time, all the surrounding nations around Israel were, for one reason or another, in a kind of a diminished state, in a state where they were held in check. Some of them by one another, others because they hadn't risen yet. But along with that sort of relative stability that was there when Solomon became king, it was also a land which was positioned where the trade routes, literally the world trade routes, were running east and west and north and south and crisscrossing the land of Israel. And Jerusalem and Israel was smack in the middle of that. They were in a place of great advantage. They were in a place where they could really, if someone handled it, managed it wisely and adroitly and shrewdly, this was a kingdom that could become very wealthy. And in fact, that's exactly what happened, because of, as I said, all those circumstances fitting together at the same time. Spiritually, Solomon started off on a really great footing with his relationship with God. Shortly after he officially took the throne from his father, he made just a few political moves in the early days of his reign, one of which was to set up an alliance with Egypt. And that was where one of Pharaoh's daughters came to become a wife and set up camp in Israel as a wife of Solomon. But in the early days, right after that happened, we get a glimpse of Solomon's relationship to God in the history in 1 Kings 3. I can just read this quickly if you don't want to turn there. In 1 Kings 3, it describes Solomon this way. Now Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. I didn't have time to really look at that to see what that was about. But and the king, Solomon, went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, "Ask what you wish me to give to you." And Solomon said, "Thou hast shown great loving kindness to thy servant David, my father, according as he has walked before thee in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart toward thee. And thou hast reserved for him this great loving kindness, that thou hast given him a son to sit on his throne, as it is this day. And now, O Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant king in place of my father David. Yet I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out and how to come in. And thy servant is in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen, a great people who cannot be numbered or counted for multitude. So give thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people and to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of thine?" And it was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said to him, "Because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself long life, nor have you asked for riches for yourself, nor have you asked for life, the life of your enemies, but you have asked for yourself discernment, to understand justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before you, nor shall one like you arise after you. And I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor. So there will not be any among the kings like you all your days. And if you walk in my ways and keep my statutes and commandments as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days." So Solomon displays this absolutely remarkable humility. And even before God gave him wisdom, he was wise to understand that what he really needed was a gift from God that would give him the ability to be a wise leader for God's people. And apparently, you get the sense that he really understood this responsibility that God had given him as a responsibility from God, and he was taking it. He couldn't have taken it more seriously. It shook him to the point where he realized, look, I'm like a trembling little baby. I don't know where to go. I don't know up, down, east, west. I need your help. This is big. This is huge. I don't know how to do this. Please give me the strength of mind and heart and will to do it as with real wisdom and understanding. So Solomon starts off in a really good place. It's not long in his life, in some respects, we get the sense that that begins to deteriorate, that he develops an increasing hardness of heart toward God. We see from the history of Israel that he adopted the practices of other kings around him whose practice was to make political alliances by marrying into other kingdoms. And then you those wives come and they bring their culture, as much of their culture as they can, and their religion and their religious practices, which God had strictly forbidden. And Solomon increasingly permitted that, even allowed them to build altars in Israel, places where all this would have been strictly forbidden by God. So there's this evidence that as time grew, he grew older, something happened, and he developed a kind of hardness toward God, a resistance. An unwillingness, a rebelliousness toward God that apparently he didn't have earlier in his youth. I remember when Carol and I we went in our earlier years to do some work in London for a couple of years, almost 2 years, and I remember there, all this happened in the States. There was a guy there that we were sort of cooperating with who had graduated from Florida Bible College. And I heard through him, we had this ongoing dialogue about a lot of things. But one of the things that sort of shook him to the roots of his life when he was there was that he learned that the college president of Florida Bible College years, probably was in his late 50s, early 60s, struck up a relationship with a student and literally ran off from his responsibilities and rebelled against God and basically shook the faith and ran away late in life. And I remember thinking to myself, huh? I don't get it. I thought you were supposed to get better, wiser, stronger. I thought you're supposed to kind of get it when you get older, and that you're, you know, you just got. That was the way I thought it went. And I remember, you know, another flash to when, again, back in the first 2 or 3 years of our marriage, we'd go to church in San Bernardino. We were working with Campus Crusade at the time and go to church, this big Baptist church there. And this guy would get up in the pulpit, and he's probably in his 40s or, as I look back now. But to me, that time, I was really an old guy. Oh, boy. But I remember him standing up in the pulpit and teaching, and there were times when he would just go off on what a sinner he was. And I just didn't get it. I just thought, you know, all you got to do is this and this and this, and man, you're walking in this, you got it put together. I couldn't understand how he could stand in front of, you know, several hundred people on the occasion from the pulpit and talk about the reality of his own sin and how he, you know, give this revealing picture of how dark his own soul was at times. And I thought, man, you guys, you got to get it together. I don't think that way anymore. I don't think that way anymore. So what I'm saying is that I can really identify with the failure that Solomon went through. And the trials, the pressures, the life that God gave him to live is, I'm still literally looking at it and thinking about it because it seems a little overwhelming to me right now. How much responsibility and how much power and how incredible his relationship to God, you know, what God had given him to do. And then the experiences that confronted him seem to be overwhelming. So just a few more comments about just the tone of the book. There's a brooding and kind of melancholy tone to the book. It's filled with doubts about specific answers. It feels doubtful for the hope of man. It seems generally pessimistic in its outlook for man, his moral and spiritual condition. But also even in the sense that there are points in the book where Solomon seems to say, look, you know, there are these things that you can do in life that are actually enjoyable and you can get something out of it. This is the best you can do. But even there, even in the places where he sort of rises out of the melancholy and sort of says something positive about his life and what he's doing and what man can do, it's always set against this backdrop of, but you can do this, but all the way through the whole book. So you know, I think I'm still reflecting and sort of meditating on all that and how God used that providentially, how we now have the privilege of looking at these writings that come out of the heart and soul and center of a man who went through all this, God providentially taking him through all this, and then we get this glimpse into that. With the result that at the end, when we look at what he's saying, and when we can conclude our observations, at least what I've got to so far in the book, there's actually something, a very profound message here. Interestingly, the word God, the title God, is all the way through the book is the name for God, Elohim, not Jehovah. There's only one other place. I mean, there may be. I don't know if I looked at all the spots, but there's 30-some uses of the word, and every one of them is Elohim, as compared to Yahweh or Jehovah. Elohim seems to be more about the power of God, the ruler of the universe, the creator. It's more of an impersonal, sovereign, transcendent God reference, whereas Jehovah is a reference to God's personal covenant relationship, his personal impassioned, interested relationship with the people of Israel. And it's interesting that he only uses that word for God, that name for God, all the way through the book. I still want to think about that a little bit, but it seems to me that gives us a clue to, one of the clues to the purpose of the book and why he's doing this, what his actual aim in the book is, who his audience really is in the end, and what he's trying to accomplish with it. I think that, whereas if you compare Ecclesiastes with Psalms or even the Proverbs, there's this distinct tone, as I said, the darkness, the melancholy, the pessimism, the uncertainty about the future. He even wonders if he even expresses the sense of he doesn't know if there's an afterlife or whether there's a heaven at all. There's no clue in here that he really knows that. But in spite of all that, it seems to me, if you compare that with Psalms and Proverbs, those places, there seems to be this rich, dense, intense, passionate knowledge, personal knowledge and relationship with God. And here you don't really see that. But it seems to me that in some respects, one way to look at what he's done here is to see this as a treatise about the questions that any human being would ask before someone offers religious answers or any answers. I mean, these are fundamental questions, fundamental in the way that we often around here refer to existential questions. These are the questions that arise when some person, any person, asks the big questions about the nature and reality of existence. So in that sense, even though this in many ways is not a religious book, and it doesn't really, it refers to God, but not in any sense like the other, those other poetic books, there is a sense in which this one does this very unique job for us in raising, I mean, there's no question in my mind that Solomon, at least at the end of his days and probably all the way through his life, is the biblical existentialist. I mean, there's a sense in which he, certainly the Old Testament, I mean, he's definitely there. And he's asking those questions that are really important and critical to him. The whole book, the other thing that's interesting about this book is that, well, I'll come to that in a second. The book has a wholeness to it. It if you read through the whole book and you get to the end, you say, yeah, I kind of get it. And then you feel like you want to go back and read it 10 more times. And even after the 10 more times, you think, I think I get the drift. But there, you don't really get this sense of this coherent unfolding message, this unfolding linear kind of argument or thought. It's not there. The first three chapters of the book, you get this sense, you get some sense of coherence and direction, and you can see one following the other. And then for a lot of the book, most of the book after that, you get these sort of pithy observations and proverbs, and they almost feel kind of random not incoherent. They're amazing wisdom there, but you have to really look to try to get a sense of the unity of the whole thing. And yet when you look at the whole book, you do definitely get that this has a feeling of one purpose in its writing. I'll just say one more thing before we actually turn to the text, and that is one of the most disturbing things about features of Ecclesiastes, or maybe even we should say it reveals something kind of disturbing about the worldview that Solomon has. That's the question that comes up, is what is his worldview, really? How informed is it by the God of heaven and earth and the history and of relationship with Israel, with God, and all that kind of thing? One of the things that's most disturbing about it is that while on the one hand he believes and fears the living God, there's no question about that. And he presents God as the only possible source of meaning and genuine happiness in life. There's no question about that, albeit in kind of cryptic, short, abbreviated ways. He also apparently has no clear picture or vision of a blessed future existence after death. And that single feature is one of the most troubling to the whole picture of Ecclesiastes. It was to me, and it still is to me a little bit, although it's starting to fit now. The more I think about the book and read it and kind of try to pull it together in my own mind. The reason it's so hard for us is because Solomon lived at a time when there was real limited, there was obviously, compared to what we have today in terms of our understanding of the gospel, which has been worked out for us by the coming of Jesus the Messiah, his death, burial, resurrection, his teaching, the accomplishments that we have now in the revelation of scriptures. We stand at the end, perhaps right at the end of this, the kingdom of this age. Whereas Solomon was positioned historically in a place where the information he had was a lot more limited. And whereas maybe David, his father, and other biblical writers might have perhaps been a little more optimistic in their outlook, whereas I think perhaps Solomon's, a lot of what happens in the tone of the book can be attributed, it seems to me, to his temperament. That is, he's a dark soul. I mean, he really struggles, I think, with that. And then his behavior and his choices feed into that and exacerbate that, making it even a more difficult outlook on life that he has to come to terms with, psychologically, I think. But we stand in a place where we have the complete picture and the great hope. And it struck me as I was reading this and thinking about it that when the shepherds stood on the hill, when the shepherds were on the hill in the story of Jesus being announced, the angels come and they announce. I don't remember the exact language, but it's something to the effect of, behold, we have good news. And I thought, after reading Ecclesiastes 3 or 4 times, yeah. Yeah, this is good news, because Solomon apparently was in a place where he was really uncertain about that. The only thing we have from Solomon is there's a judgment coming. Even though he doesn't, at one point he actually refers to whether, he wonders whether a beast, an animal, who turns to dust and falls to the ground in dust and death, if man, as a beast, is any better than that. Is our future any different than that? Any better? Do we rise from that? He poses that question. So there's some really interesting and tough stuff to wrestle with and trying to put together his worldview. Okay, well, we're going to get started here, but not very far. But let's turn to the text and do that. The words of the preacher... That is Koheleth, the son of David, king of Jerusalem. Talked a little bit about his role there as the assembly, the speaker before the assembly. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Wow, what a way to start. He doesn't pull any punches. He just lays it right out there at the beginning. And in these two little poetic phrases captures really his perspective on the existential experience, the real life lived experience of man. It's futile. There's futility shot through the whole thing. The word vanity actually is the Hebrew word for breath or vapor. And you get the idea here that basically what he's communicating is that man's existence in all of its apparent reality and achievement and glory is but a, if you compare a breath, a vapor, with anything, something solid, a body, something material, I think that's the picture he's trying to present, is that man's life is like a breath, it's like a vapor that is barely there and then it's gone. There's no substance. When he says all is vanity, I think he's basically just saying, look, all of the experience of man on this earth, when it's all said and done, is futile. So that's where he begins. And I just make mention of the fact that he uses that word. The word for breath, vanity, is used 8 times in the Psalms, 4 times in Job, 8 times in Jeremiah. These are the most usages, 30 times in Ecclesiastes. So I think we get the picture that he's presenting. I think we get the picture. Okay, I think what I'll do, I'll just... A couple more verses here. What advantage, verse 3, what advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? Now, here we have a clue, actually, I think, again, to the character of the book. This word advantage is also translated profit. What profit does someone have under the sun? what profit or advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? One of the interesting problems with this book, in terms of the critical approach to it, is that the language here is unique. There's no other wisdom literature that we have that compares to it. And therefore, a lot of biblical scholars, starting in the last century, started basically assuming that this book was written after the Assyrian and Babylonian captivities. At least that was the theory that, like, for example, Kyle and Dalich, one of the primary Old Testament commentaries that we have, that these are, the language here doesn't fit the period of 900 BC. It's more like the 400, 500 BC. But the fact is, more scholarly work has been done, and the fact is that it doesn't fit any. It doesn't fit that period any better than it does the 900 BC period. But the interesting thing about the language is that the one thing they have come up with is that the language seems to have a structure and familiarity, a tone to it that can be associated with other Near Eastern, the immediate peoples, that, like the Philistine, the Canaanite languages. And these peoples were basically trading. They were traders. They were deeply entrepreneurial tradespeople. And their cultures were infatuated with that. They were driven by that. They were characterized by being a people of trade. So the view that is taken of this, the language used in that Solomon or the writer here uses, is that he's basically borrowing genres of language that are taken from those peoples, which were heavily saturated with trade, culture, profit, market, that kind of culture and living. The fact is, I got to thinking about it, when you think about Solomon's time, his whole life was basically about entrepreneuring the kingdom that he was responsible for onto a higher and higher plane of success and stability and power and wealth among all the kingdoms that were around him. To those other cultures from which scholars are suggesting that he pulls his style of writing and the genre of a language. So all of a sudden it started to occur to me that really Solomon's experience is hugely informed and saturated by this project that God had given him of putting Israel on the map and of building the kingdom. And what did that mean? It meant building it in a material sense. So when we see this word advantage or profit, that's exactly what that word connotes. The word is about what profit, what good thing, what material thing, what substantive thing can come from man's work in all that he endeavors to achieve, to conjure up, to make, to give his heart, soul, life, and mind to, with the result that here's the product at the end. And isn't that a valuable thing? What advantage, and it's all cast in this sense of sort of commerce and trade and success in that kind of sense. The language of which he does under the sun, he's going to repeat this a couple of times. This term under the sun, I think, is the Solomon's way of saying all the things that happen. You picture the earth, you know, here's a picture, here's the earth, and here's the sun up above. I mean, that's the way we think about it. It's the way kids draw, you know. That's one of the great subject matters of children's drawings. It's a landscape with the sun above it. And it's interesting because it sort of pictures what I think Solomon is getting at here, is that here's the world, and all the world sits under the sun. And when the sun shines in the sky and it shines down on the world and on the earth, it shows all the achievements of man, the nature of man, the work of man, the glory of man, and everything else. So under the sun is just this term of everything that happens. And then he goes into, I'll just take a few more minutes and then we'll open it up for some questions. Then he goes in for the next few verses to use some metaphors that he's observing. As to the proof of this idea that he's going to start building, that everything is futile, everything is vain, everything has this, everything is but breath, compared to something that he's looking for. He says in verse 4, "A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. Also the sun rises and the sun sets and hastens to its place, there arising again, blowing toward the south and then toward the north. The wind continues swirling along, and on its circular courses the wind returns. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, there they flow again. All things are wearisome." Now, stop there. So he picks out, what is it, 1, 2, 3, 4, basically 5 metaphors to sort of, that are observations that from nature and creation and man's experience in the first one, that sort of back up this idea that, you know, when you look out there at reality and you really give it a good look, you would conclude that everything has this kind of circularity, repeating, not going anywhere kind of character. So, for example, generation to generation, the same thing. A generation goes, a generation comes. The idea of the cycling, one generation comes along, another one comes along, another one comes along. They all kind of repeat the same thing. They don't really learn from one another. He makes that pointedly later. But the earth, and by comparison, is the only solid thing. Literally, the physical earth is the only solid thing that I can see out there. And then he starts to talk about what he sees on the earth. What does he see? He sees the sun. The sun rises, the sun sets, the sun only to rise and set and rise and set and rise and set again and again and again and again. This sort of sense of this great glorious thing that happens with the sun comes up and it goes across the sky and then it sets beautifully, but then the next day it happens again and then it... So again, this sort of repeating, this repetition, it hastens back to its place and just starts all over again. And then he goes to the metaphor of the wind, and he says, "Blowing toward the south and turning towards the north, the wind continues swirling along. On its circular course, the wind returns." Here's another figure of kind of ceaseless repetition, but you get the sense of the uncontrollability, the invisibility of the swirling of the wind, sort of blowing here, blowing there, almost in a kind of way that sort of exhausts, it gets the feeling of sort of exhausting all the possibilities. The wind blows here, the wind blows there. But in the end, it swirls and circles and it doesn't really yield anything. It just returns to do the same thing. Then he goes to the sea, really. He says all the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. And I think there is really his point there is that the sea is this vast mass of water. There's this body of water, and all these masses of rivers and streams are flowing into this reservoir of water, this vast water. But when you look at it, it doesn't really seem to go up or down. It just stays the same. It doesn't fill up and overflow with all this water coming and coming and coming and coming and coming. And flowing into it, it doesn't really get any bigger. And I think the idea behind that is that there's no apparent gain from all this activity, as it were, of the river flowing into the sea. You might look at the sea as gaining this water that's coming and coming and doesn't stop. But the fact is, the sea remains the same. It doesn't really fill up. And then he talks about the rivers flowing. The cycle of the river, the rivers flow into the sea is not full. To the place where the rivers flow, they flow again. Here the idea is you get this picture of, here's the sea, here are the rivers flow in, the sea doesn't fill up, it turns to vapor off the sea, goes up, rains, starts again into the rivers, flows down. So again, you get this sense of repetition, of the cycle, of the world and nature. And as beautiful as it might seem, I mean, you could picture a person standing in some place where you can see the sea and you can see a river flowing into it and some streams and this beautiful, awesome picture of creation and nature. And yet Solomon's looking at it through the lenses of his experience. He's saying, you know, that's as beautiful as that might seem. It's actually kind of a picture of how I see man's striving in the world. That for all of his striving, for all of our effort, for all of what we do, we still end up in this really futile place. So I'm going to stop there. I'll pick it up next week, but I want to leave just a few moments here for some comments or some questions that you might have. I'm not sure I have the answers, but in any case, you can see that you can start to see the tone of the book and where he's going and what's driving it. So let's stop there for now and leave a few moments. Questions, comments? You can give testimonials here too.
It seems like Solomon was kind of a manic depressive guy. But this description of how he sees things seems to me like what so many people have to go through, realizing the futility of life and the absurdity of our daily cycle of activity just to get up and do it again the next day in order to come to an end of ourselves and an end of believing that there's anything of true lasting value in this life as a precondition to really cry out for salvation, cry out for that force beyond ourselves that can offer us true value and lasting hope.
Exactly.
I wonder if in his brilliance he was articulating this as recognizing that this is one of those stages that a human being has to go through, and that, you know, if later in his life or maybe what he says at the end of the book would indicate that he did in fact himself come to a place of crying out for the one true God, and have that kind of an epiphany in his personal life, or if he went to his grave in this kind of despair and hopelessness.
I think that question is one of the most difficult and troubling questions to face objectively as you read this literature. At the end of it, I tend to lean at this point that to the effect there's enough clues there that I think he really was a believer, that he really, and what I mean by that is he truly grasped and embraced God's picture of our condition and reality in the world and the cosmos. He embraced God, what he understood to be God's picture of that, rather than the world's picture of that or another picture of that. Even though he, for years, spent his time, we will find out, he spent a lot of energy and a lot of time trying to actually construct or explore for a worthy surrogate or replacement for that. And I think you're right on, Kevin. I think that's why I concluded that this is one of the most amazing books in terms of with clear, steely-eyed truth speaks to the experience of the human being and the creature, and doesn't pull any punches and puts it out there just like that. Just a couple of quick questions and we'll have to let you go.
So what I heard was that by Solomon recognizing that all is vanity, that's the indication of his salvation. That a fallen and non-elect, heaven forbid I use that phrase, but somebody who, because we all, I think everybody has seen that experience, those people who continue to throw themselves into one thing after another and never stop and have that pause to write Ecclesiastes like Solomon did. I mean, what I'm hearing is you're saying that's the indication that there's something going on in him that's genuine.
Yeah, and following on what Kevin says, absolutely, I think that's the fact that he saw this world And all that he accomplished, we'll go into this next week, what he accomplished was absolutely amazing. It was huge. It was gigantic. It was glorious. It was powerful. And he was seduced by it. I mean, he really explored it. But in the end, according to what we're reading here, he sees that all that stuff he accomplished, by comparison with what God has, what God owns, and we don't own, it's like a breath. It almost doesn't exist.
Does that really change for us even today, though? I mean, in some respects, God's futility and this is life is just striving after nothing. I mean, there's the fear of God and keep his commandments, but other than that, like what we do at our occupations and what we do, what kind of cars we drive.
I really think so. I think that's what Kevin was saying, is that we all go through, those of us who are, by mercy of God, given eyes to see and ears to hear. If we come to the same place that Solomon goes to, that we understand this world by comparison with what we understand the gospel to be offering us, this world is totally insubstantial. It just cannot be compared. And then you think of that New Testament language of this world is not worthy to be compared, you know. What we have is not worthy to be compared with what's awaiting us. I think all those kinds of that kind of language is there relevant to this issue here.
Thank you.
Just one more quick one.
I just wanted to say, Wes, thanks. You've really, I think, painted. I've just seen a really beautiful picture here of a man who, his father was the second king other than Saul. The kingdom's just being established. His father was a warrior, and that's why. God said, I won't let you build my house, but I'll let your son build it. So you have a warrior father. Now you have the time of rich and plenty, the kind of idle rich kid's
son. The arty guy.
Yeah. And so he can ask questions and he can contemplate. And I just skipped ahead and was looking, I mean, through 1st and 2nd Chronicles, some of the actual dialogue between God and Solomon. And when he does this several-page prayer of dedication, he asks, even then, he's contemplative. He says, well, God, I've built this house, but will you really reign here? And I was noticing, too, that to both David and to Solomon, he keeps stressing that this kingdom will last forever. And what Solomon seems to realize is, but man doesn't. Hmm. And he seems to be very brooding about that, and I really appreciate how you've brought that out. And I think I can. I appreciate what you've painted here.
Thanks. I think we all identify at some level here with it. Okay. Thank you very much. We're done.